Welcome to the Oral History Review at the Oxford University Press blog. Occasionally, we like to break up the monotony of text posts with a podcast, celebrate the oral in oral history, so to speak. With these podcasts, we hope to give the Oral History Review's authors and editors a place to elaborate on or build upon their scholarship. Furthermore, as with all of our social media efforts, we aim to build awareness of the art and craft of oral history. The following podcast is hosted by Troy Reeves, the Oral History Review's managing editor and head of the Oral History Program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Enjoy.
Thanks, Andrew. Today we're going to talk to Mark Cave and Stephen Sloan. Mark is the senior curator and oral historian at the Historic New Orleans Collection, and Stephen is an associate professor of history and the director of the Institute for Oral History at Baylor University. And today we're going to be talking to them primarily about their new book, Listening on the Edge, Oral History in the Aftermath of Crisis, published by Oxford University Press. Enjoy.
I'll start right off with thanking you both for being a part of this podcast. And I usually ask folks who are on the podcast how they get interested in oral history. So I wonder if we could start off by having each of you address how you became interested in oral history.
I'm Mark Cave. I'm the oral historian here at the Historic New Orleans Collection. And I'm a senior curator here. And I started using oral history along with our acquisitions process when we acquired things, just to give context to the material that we were bringing in to our collections. The nature of our collecting changed significantly after Katrina, and you know, most of the 3 or 4 years following Katrina was spent in a large documentary project devoted to Katrina, and so our oral history program really began with that, and so that's been the focus of my work ever since.
This is Stephen Sloan, and my interest in oral history goes back to I became really interested just as a historian on the way the experience of historical phenomenon or issues can vary so much by perspective on events, and getting different perspectives around a particular event and looking at the different ways that angle and viewpoint determines experience and impact and meaning and all those sorts of things. And oral history offered kind of an opportunity to approach that I didn't see with any other methodologies, as far as very democratic and open-ended way to try to get at understanding the experience of others. And so that's what got me interested in it. And of course, as I moved into more graduate work and things like that, I found applications for it. And my first job was at the Center for Oral History and Cultural Heritage at the University of Southern Mississippi, which is a great collection and a great place to do oral history. And then I've continued that on, and now I'm at Baylor. And I am continually fascinated at the ways in which I'm always learning new things about events that I think I know about. And that's one of the things I love about oral history, just this continuing process of discovery.
Great. Thank you both. So now let's shift to the book. And so how did you two become involved in the process of publishing the book?
The story starts with Mark, so I'll let you start the story, Mark.
When I started our Katrina project, I really felt over my head. You know, I wasn't sure, you know, how to approach an oral history project devoted to a crisis that had just happened. You know, and I wasn't sure, you know, if I should be interviewing people so soon after the event. But it was sort of a mandate from my institution that I do it. And so when I got further along in the process, I proposed an idea for a book where each chapter of the book would be devoted to a different part of the project that I was doing related to Katrina, and each chapter devoted to a different lesson learned in my experience. And I brought the idea to the Oxford editorial board, and they liked the idea but thought it would be better if each chapter was devoted to a different world crisis, so that the book would give sort of the varied nature of crisis. So they teamed me up with Stephen, and we just started searching for crisis oral history projects all over the world.
Yeah, I was on the Mississippi side of Hurricane Katrina there at USM, and it's interesting, Mark and I both published about work we were doing in the Oral History Review, I think, before we really got even partnered up. So we were already thinking about the work, and and the meaning of the work, and just the idea of drawing in what this might look like in other contexts, and how other oral historians are dealing with this or approaching it, I found really fascinating. And both Mark and I served as chair of the Emerging Crises Oral History Research Fund that the Oral History Association offers. And through that, seeing these incredible projects that are going on globally in these places in which oral historians are trying to work right in the aftermath of catastrophe to try to document and try to understand what happened and try to give people an opportunity to have their experience captured just energized me more and more for the importance of this sort of work.
Thanks. So let's talk about the book in terms of, you know, it's been out for a while now, so what have you seen in terms of response to the work?
I think the response has been really good. We've had, I know it's been being used in the classroom, which is, you know, something that we could only hope. First off, just the authors are wonderful in the way in which they're proud of the book and proud of the opportunity. What I like about the book is it gives the opportunity not only to share things from their narrators, which we always love doing as oral historians. It gave them a way to not only deliver content of their work, but reflect on the meaning of their work, which oftentimes authors don't get the opportunity to do. We just deliver the goods. We don't reflect on what it means and the significance of it. So I think the authors really appreciated that. I think the book has been received well because it's kind of a ubiquitous phenomenon. People are looking at crisis, but it's also a book that there's very few that include, you know, things from Rwanda to the Virginia Tech shootings to 9/11 to refugee crises in Australia. And so just the diverse nature of the subject matter in the book, I think, has made it be received very well.
I think that the format of the book has been very well received as well, where we really put the narrator's voice first and center. Like, we have a significant excerpt from an interview, about 3,000 words, that begin each chapter of the book, and then that's followed by an essay, about 5,000-word essay by the interviewer about their work.
You may have addressed this, but was it mainly through the Emerging Crises Fund that you found the people who provided the chapters, or were there other ways, or a little bit of both?
We looked everywhere. And so it was through oral history networks that we found them. It was through finding folks that may have published things where we knew they were using oral history. Mark and I both go to the International Oral History Association meeting, through the National Oral History Association meeting. And so we kind of scoured. We asked for recommendations from colleagues and looking here and there. Some of the projects we were aware of, and some of them, there were 6 degrees of searching that got us to them.
And, you know, I think that oral historians are sort of brought into crisis environments by chance. You know, something happens in their community, kind of like Stephen and I with Katrina, and they're not necessarily the, you know, primary scholars in the field. And so, you know, we really had to search different places to find contributors. We even had a military chaplain who was working at a Walter Reed Medical Center, and he was interviewing soldiers and other chaplains there.
Thanks for that. So the next question is how the book has influenced your thoughts about oral history, particularly doing oral history on current event topics and obviously ones that deal with crisis or catastrophe or people who've experienced trauma because of it.
Well, I think it put to rest a lot of my fears about doing oral history soon after a crisis. We have a wonderful chapter by a psychologist who, you know, talks about trauma and, you know, how oral history can, you know, help people put their experience in context and help them move beyond crisis, and kind of reassured me that if somebody's willing to talk, then it's generally okay to conduct an interview with them.
Yeah, you know, and I feel like as a public historian, you know, I think history is always contested and constructed, and so it's much more fluid, kind of the way we remember things and the way the shifting and changing memory of things. And so I think there's this false notion among some that at some point the memory of something becomes fixed, and at that point we should record it and make sure it's captured. And so I think it's important, you know, to step in, even early on, as things are rapidly changing and have it documented, I think it reveals some aspect of it, and there's another aspect of it that can be revealed 5 and 10 years down the road if additional interviews are done. But, you know, that idea of someone thinking historically and someone thinking like an oral historian and capturing it at that point, coming in with a very different set of concerns and value sets than most folks that are documenting things at that point.
It also made me realize the limits of journalism and how, you know, journalism is often so market driven, and the need for oral history alongside journalism when documenting events. I think that oral history is generally not seen to be as self-serving or as opportunistic as journalistic work is. So it often gives us access to interviewees that journalists don't have access to. And I think it just provides people with more context.
Thanks. So a couple more questions. The first is again related to the book, and that's any advice or any sort of best practices for those who want to or feel the need to jump in and do an oral history project on a crisis as it's happening?
Well, you know, as I mentioned in the book, you know, I think at times it can be, if not done well, it can be exploitive, it can be voyeuristic, it can be injuring someone who has already just experienced injury. But I think if it's done well, if it's done with empathy and with patience and with a desire for the narrator to express their own experience of things, if they're ready, as Mark pointed out. One thing that we learned that Mark talked about, we have one of my favorite chapters is by a psychologist in the book, and she talks about the public meaning of oral history, the public purpose of oral history, and the ways in which, even as opposed to psychotherapy that has a very private purpose, the public purpose of oral history can be extremely valuable if they're willing to engage in that. And so, but not everyone is willing. And so I think being really sensitive, extra sensitive to what the interviewer is going through, that they're vulnerable, you know, they're closely associated with events, by distance and emotionally, very close to events. And so it requires a lot of flexibility. It requires a lot of sensitivity. It requires to, make sure you're working toward a life history approach with interviewees. So you're contextualizing the experience within a larger frame of a life rather than just sitting the trauma in the middle of the table and focusing on that event. And I think also the life history tells you more about the event than you think as you look at the way in which they talk about a broader life around the crisis that's the point of the interview. So I think there are ways to do it well, but all the things we try to attend to as oral historians become that much more important in these sort of environments.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with Stephen about the life story approach to interviewing after a crisis. It really informs how they respond to traumatic events, and I think that probably the most interesting chapter with regards to life story is Taylor Krause's work in Rwanda, and he did these really long life story interviews with survivors of the Rwandan genocide, and they were so long because the interviewees really felt the need to try to salvage the history of their family. You know, sometimes they were the only surviving member of their family or their village, and so they really felt this responsibility to speak for them and to salvage their memory of everything that had been destroyed. I think that's one of the most moving chapters in the book.
Yeah, definitely.
Stephen, I think another thing you addressed, which I found interesting in that concluding chapter, was also the how it could affect the interviewer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure I heard you say that in your answer. If you did, I apologize. If not, I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit more about how the interviewer might be affected by this type of oral history project.
Yeah, it's. I think this is one of the reasons why investigators would stay away from a topic like this. You know, the idea of objectivity and subjectivity, particularly as academicians, we want to approach topics that we feel like we can be more objective about, things that we can kind of hold at a distance and analyze, as I point out in the book, in a little more sterile or controlled environment. And this is not that. This is subjectivity. You're kind of stepping into the middle of things, and many of our interviewers talked about akin to vicarious traumatization. You know, they are experiencing the trauma, not only the trauma of the interviewee they're dealing with, but all the interviewees that they're dealing with, and the ways in which hearing these stories, and not only today, but maybe several today and tomorrow, and diving into this project and hearing them over and over. And so self-care is something that we talk about in the book. That's something that has to be built into a project. Interviewers have to be aware, and our authors talk about this, how they created devices to vent or get away or cope with the stories that they were hearing. It is extremely important to build in as a best practice.
I think Mary Marshall Clark talks about that in her chapter as well, where the interviews would talk frequently about what they were doing with other interviewers and administrators of the project. And I think talking about what you've been hearing is very helpful in sort of processing that vicarious trauma.
I'm wondering if you two had to deal with this in your interviews that you did with Katrina folks. I mean, and maybe particularly Mark, since Mark, you know, was in New Orleans at the time.
Our project focused primarily on first responders. And they had generally seen a mental health professional before I got to them. But I found that they really wanted to share their story. It was a little bit different in that, particularly here in New Orleans, first responders were often blamed for the sort of social meltdown in New Orleans following the crisis, you know, through their bad actions in the case of the police department or inaction in the case of FEMA or some of the other organizations. So they had a real desire to tell their story, to give their perspective of what happened, since so many of them were being blamed by the media for what happened. And I thought that was very interesting. At first I was concerned about how, you know, they might use the interview for their own ends. But really, I think most of them just wanted their perspective to be heard. And so many of them were afraid to talk to the media because they were afraid of how the story might be spun, and kind of embraced oral history as an alternative to the media.
Stephen, do you have anything you want to add to self-care in your own?
Yeah, for me, I just had to balance, you know, the work. Mark's experience, oftentimes if you're dealing with some of our interviewers that are at institutions that were kind of based in these areas that they're trying to study and research, and so these places where, you know, they could just as well be interviewed as the person that they're interviewing. You know, I think in spacing out the work, getting away, maybe doing some interviews on other topics at times, I would say that, much like Mark shared, most of the people that I ran into had a willingness to share their story. On the Mississippi side, they felt like their story was undershared as far as the Katrina experience. And so although they had traumatic stories to share, most of the experience of them sharing the stories was not one of loss. The tone of it was more the empowerment and the idea of recovery through telling their stories, not additional loss through telling their stories. And, of course, I think that made the difference in most of the interviews I had to do.
Thank you. Any other final thoughts about the book that you'd like to express?
I'm really proud of it. I think it's a, sort of a really unique tool that I think would benefit anyone who is doing work in the aftermath of a crisis. And I think the chapters are varied enough that no matter what crisis that you're dealing with, I think that there's something in here that would be very helpful and useful to you.
Yeah, and I think, like Mark mentioned earlier, I think it honors the narrators well. That's one of the things I like about the book. And I think it's about sharing their stories, and then, but it also allows that space for the interviewers to, like I said, reflect kind of on the meaning of their work, which I think is something we don't get to do enough. I'm really proud of the book. It was a great experience working with Mark and doing it. And, you know, I love the picture it gives of oral history. It's a very big tent, oral history is. These are not just historians. These are folks coming from all sorts of perspectives and working in all sorts of environments and doing this sort of interview research. And that's one of the things I like about it is how eclectic it is.
I like the fact, too, that it's not overly academic. It's very approachable. I think, you know, some of the crises we were dealing with are just so dramatic and everything that a really formal academic approach to some of the essays would have almost seemed inappropriate. You know, you were dealing with such emotional issues that I think we hit a really good tone with the chapters.
Great, thanks. So the book is called Listening on the Edge, Oral History in the Aftermath of Crisis. The editors and contributors are Mark Cave and Stephen Sloan. Mark, Stephen, I want to thank you both for your time this afternoon. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Troy.
Thank you, Troy.